Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design. I'm Tom Gilson. Today's episode, theistic evolution has a logic problem, materialism has a history problem. The occasion of today's episode, Crossway Books has a big new anthology out, Theistic Evolution, a Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. It weighs in at more than 1,000 pages and has several well-known authors who bring to the table a wide range of expertise. To help publicize the book, Crossway put a few of these authors behind the camera to distill some key arguments. Today, we're going to hear clips from two of those authors, a pair who also served as editors on the project, Biola University philosopher J.P. Moreland and philosopher of science Stephen Meyer. We begin with Moreland, who briefly defines the idea of theistic evolution and describes what he sees as a basic contradiction at its heart.
There are certain understandings of theistic evolution that are logically contradictory. There are some versions of it that aren't logically contradictory, but some are, and the most classic one is this. Evolution says that the development of life is a completely unguided process that is random and according to natural law, but there's no guiding it in any direction. There's no end point that this is moving toward. Well, theistic evolution accepts that. They accept the theory of evolution as an unguided process, but then they say, but God somehow guided the process. And that's why we're theistic evolutionists, because we want to hold that God guided the process. Well, you can't have a process that's guided and unguided at the same time. That is completely contradictory. Now, there are some who will say, well, no, we believe that the process was in fact guided by God, so it wasn't unguided. But if I'm going to be a good theistic evolutionist, I can't allow anything God did to be detectable. Because if we could detect what God did, then theistic evolution would lose to intelligent design, and we would have God's nose poking into science. And so those theistic evolutionists say, well, God guided the process as long as we can never tell what he did. I wonder if that's any different than saying that he didn't guide it in the first place.
Now, a lot of evolutionists will shoot back. They'll say intelligent design has its own logic problem. It commits the God of the Gaps fallacy. But Stephen Meyer says, no, that charge goes wide of the mark.
A God of the Gaps argument is an argument that has a formal logical structure that in logic is known as an argument from ignorance. It's an informal fallacy. And arguments from ignorance have the following form. If I say cause A is not sufficient to produce effect X, and then I say, therefore, cause B must have produced X, but I have no independent evidence that cause B can produce X, then I've committed a fallacy of arguing from ignorance. Because just because A isn't sufficient to produce the effect in question doesn't mean that some other cause did it. You have to have independent evidence that that other cause is capable of doing it. And the that then becomes a God of the Gaps argument when you say, well, various natural processes aren't sufficient to produce, say, the origin of the first life or the origin of the first animals in the history of life. And then if I were to say, therefore God did it, that would be a God of the Gaps argument. It would be an argument from ignorance. But that's not how we're arguing when we make the case for intelligent design, because we're adding an additional premise. We're saying that various kinds of natural processes are not sufficient to produce the origin of new functional information. And we're specifically dialed into the presence of the digital code that's stored in the DNA molecule that performs important biological functions. It's information in a very specific technical sense. So we say we show that various natural processes are insufficient to produce these large infusions of information we see arising in the history of life that are necessary to build new forms of life. But then we point out from observation of the world around us that we do know of a cause that does produce information. We have independent evidence that intelligent agency, that mind, that creative intelligence can generate information. you and I are doing it right now as we're talking. We're trading notes, trading information. So information is, in our experience, a mind product. We have independent experience that minds produce information. And so when we infer an intelligent agent as having acted in the past based on the presence of digital code stored in the macromolecules of life, we're not arguing from ignorance. We're arguing from our knowledge of cause and effect, and specifically what we know minds can do, namely produce information that merely undirected material processes can't.
Philosopher J.P. Moreland extends this analysis. He says there's a danger in thinking that science alone can lead to true knowledge. And he says the danger isn't just to religion or theology or the humanities. Moreland says the assumption actually impedes science itself, puts it in a straitjacket.
There are actually ways that certain scientific assumptions can impede the scientific search for truth. One of those assumptions is that the only kind of cause that we can discover for an effect we're trying to understand is a purely physical, natural cause. But among other things, this is going to leave out human agency. Sometimes a person does and creates an effect or does it intentionally, and the cause is their own free will and their own mental life. It's not a physical thing at all. And so by always having to find some brain cause, you reduce the role of the agent, and certain aspects of psychology that focus on the agent are set aside in favor of brain research. Now, it should be a both and, but if it's only the brain, you're in trouble. Similarly, when you're simply searching for purely physical causes, what would become of archaeology? If I have to find a natural cause for pottery or for an arrowhead, that would be ridiculous. Surely I can look for a personal cause for those things, but why not biology? What if the biological evidence or the paleontological evidence is best explained by the actions of an intelligent being? The assumption of science does not allow for that kind of explanation. And consequently, it has a straitjacket on it that keeps it from being able to advance as widely as it could.
So Moreland argues that scientism is too cramped a toolkit even for the natural scientist doing natural science. Moreland insists that scientism impoverishes science. Now we can come at this issue from the opposite side and ask, what ideas beyond scientism could, or have, enriched science? Stephen Meyer, both a philosopher and historian of science, argues that the birth of modern science, the scientific revolution itself, provides some very clear answers.
Methodological naturalism is a convention that has really only been around since the late 19th century. Science actually got started in a very explicitly theistic and indeed Christian milieu. The period of time that historians call the scientific revolution is roughly 1300 to 1700. There's debate about when it actually starts and how much the Protestants versus the Catholics were responsible, but clearly theological ideas, Christian theological ideas, had a huge role in the formation of and the foundation of modern science. One of those key ideas was actually the idea of intelligibility, that nature is intelligible. There's an order and a design that can be understood and discerned by the scientist because nature is the product of a rational mind, a rational intellect, namely the mind of God, and that same mind or creator who made nature with that rational order built into it made us and our reason so that we could perceive and understand the reason that he built into nature. And that was what gave people confidence to do the hard work of investigation to figure out, well, what is the hidden order? What is the design that is beneath the appearances in natural phenomena? The first thing to say is that science did not arise because of a set of naturalistic presuppositions. It actually arose because of a conviction that there was a lawful order in nature, that human beings could discern and understand it because they'd been made in the image of the creator of that order, And that also they needed to go investigate, because while they might expect that there's a rational order there, the Greeks believe the same, they also knew that the rational order was contingent on the choice of the creator. This was a product of recovering the doctrine of creation in the late Middle Ages. And since the order in nature is contingent on the act of the creator, we have to go and look and see what kind of an order he put into it. We can't just simply sit in our armchairs and deduce it from logical first principles. The Greeks and the Ptolemaic astronomy was a good example of this. They figured that, well, since the most perfect form of motion is a circle, and since the planets are in the heavenly realm, they must be inscribing circular orbits. But in fact, they were doing ellipses. So the early modern scientists broke with the ancient Greeks and said, since nature's created by God and he could have done otherwise, we need to go and find out not what he must have done, as Robert Boyle said, but what he did do, which means empirical investigation. You got to look and see. So there were a number of ways in which Christianity gave rise to modern science, and the idea that a set of naturalistic assumptions is necessary to do science, I think, is just historically false.
That was Stephen Meyer, Program Director for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, one of the editors of the new book, Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. He was joined by philosopher J.P. Moreland. To hear more of their thinking, and for articles from an impressive cross-section of scientists, philosophers, and theologians, jump over to Amazon and order a copy of Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. The first print run apparently sold out very quickly, but as of this recording, the publisher has more on the shelves and ready to ship. Check it out at Amazon, and if you get a chance to read the book, please join the conversation in the review section there on the book's Amazon page. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back next time.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.